House Speaker Paul Ryan announced Wednesday he will leave Congress after his term is up in January, not seek re-election in the midterms. He delivered remarks to reporters and insisted his decision came down to family.
Some of you know my story. My dad died when I was 16, the age my daughter is. And I just don't want to be one of those people looking back at my life thinking I spent more time with my kids when I know if I spend another term, they will only know me as a weekend father.
It is where we begin Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and at the table this week, it's Annalise Eicher. She is program director at partner organizations One Wisconsin Now and One Wisconsin Institute, and she's a Dane County Board supervisor. Annalise, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
And Owen Robinson is here. He's a columnist at the West Bend Daily News. He blogs at bootsandsabers.com. Owen, welcome back.
Good morning, and good morning, Annalise.
And you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. First off, reaction to House Speaker Paul Ryan's decision this week not to run for re-election. And we're going to start right in on that with Annalise. You're from Janesville. What stood out to you about Speaker Ryan's announcement?
Well, yes, I do share a hometown with Speaker Paul Ryan. And turns out we have the high school rivalry. He went to Craig, I went to Parker. But I don't think it's any surprise that Paul Ryan is not running for re-election. Even he, as Speaker of the House, can recognize that the tide is turning. You know, since Trump took office, there have been at least 46 House Republicans that have resigned or made retirement plans. And, you know, Paul Ryan is just joining the group.
Owen, what do you make of this?
Well, I think I agree. It's no surprise. That doesn't make it any less, politically earth-shaking within Wisconsin. There's certainly a lot of implications to that resignation. He's been in Congress for a couple decades now, so it really does have an impact. And he's had that southeast corner locked up for Republicans for a very, very long time. So, but, you know, Paul Ryan has said for years and years and years that he does want to spend more time with his family. He's known to be the guy who flies home every weekend, unlike a lot of congressmen, to spend time with his family, to do the trips, to all of that. And you have to remember, he never wanted to be speaker. And I think at his heart, Ryan is a policy guy. He likes to do policy. He likes to do the wonky work of congressional work. And the speaker's job is not that. The speaker's job is to rally the cats to push an agenda, which just he was never comfortable with. It's not something that fits his nature. And I think, honestly, he's uncomfortable carrying the Trump agenda forward. It's not one that he completely agrees with on all fronts. And it's a different set of priorities, whereas Ryan was all about entitlement reform and tax reform and doing some of the big structural changes within government that he thought and many of us think are necessary. Trump has different priorities. And I think that even if the Republicans keep the House, which is certainly not outside the realm of possibility, but even if they keep the House, that just isn't a role he necessarily wanted to serve. So I think a combination of factors make him want to stay home. And I think he certainly has put in his time serving the citizens of Wisconsin, and we should thank him for it. I think that does leave in his wake a very, very interesting race in the first congressional district with a lot of people jockeying already to see who's going to go for it. But it's an interesting district from a landscape standpoint, from what communities it serves, but also an interesting district from where it sits politically within Wisconsin and in the nation.
Well, Annalise, some critics have said that Paul Ryan saw the writing on the wall here when it comes to the forthcoming midterm election. But he said he is confident about the future of the party in his announcement. Let's take a listen here.
I am proud of what this conference has achieved, and I believe its future is bright. The economy is strong. We've given Americans greater confidence in their lives. And I have every confidence that I'll be handing this gavel on to the next Republican Speaker of the House next year.
But reporters did question him about a blue wave.
You know, they did. And, you know, I think it's funny to talk about, you know, Paul Ryan's decades in office and his accomplishments and the, you know, what Congress has accomplished. Prior to Paul Ryan becoming Speaker, he had three bills passed, one of which was renaming my hometown post office. You know, I struggle with, you know, him not wanting the job of speaker and him, you know, calling himself, you know, that weekend dad that, you know, doesn't want this job. Well, the job that he did want not too long ago was vice president of the United States. And he was willing to, you know, run for vice president and potentially take all that time away, you know, from his family. And if he had had his way, he'd probably be in the 6 year as vice president right now. And I struggle with, you know, his reasonings and his, you know, rhetoric and in writing off, you know, well, this is not something I wanted to do. If he had done what he had wanted to do, you know, he would have been more entrenched in D.C. than what he, you know, has been for the last couple decades. And, you know, Paul Ryan has proved that in America, if you're born rich, you can still achieve your dreams of, you know, one day giving yourself a massive tax break if you hang around D.C. long enough. And he's, you know, hung around D.C. long enough. He's taking his tax break and he's going home.
Owen, let's give you an opportunity to respond to that.
You know, I think a lot of Annalisa's comments are rooted in the fact that she just doesn't believe Paul Ryan in saying what he said. And he said he's resigning for the reasons he's resigning. And I take him at his word because, frankly, I have no reason to doubt that's the case. I think talking about his record is interesting and that his legacy and that as a congressman, when he was just a congressman, he certainly had not the traction I think he wanted. And I think largely because most of the things he did, he was trying to tackle the big stuff that nobody in D.C. wants to do, things like entitlement reform, things like major tax reform. And those were the things he was out there championing, trying to grow support for. And as I think we've seen, it's very difficult to get anybody in Washington to want to push back on the beast that has become our federal government. So I think that's certainly understandable. I think his very short tenure as Speaker is actually quite impressive. And many of the things that the House did, they did repeal Obamacare. They did the tax bill that was actually passed that went through. They did pass lots of entitlement reform. They did pass all kinds of stuff, most of which, frankly, died in the Senate, which is unfortunate. But it's not because Paul Ryan and the House Republicans didn't do the heavy lifting to try to pass the bills of the changes they did. But I do think he wants to go home and spend time with his family. I think he's still a relatively young man. I wouldn't be surprised to see
48.
Him enter politics again. Yep. As someone in my 40s, I consider that a pretty young man. So I'm just going to say. but I think he still has quite a political future. If he wants it, certainly he's proven to be a smart, capable person that could probably go into a number of fields and be quite successful. So I thank him for his service, and I hope he enjoys his time with his family. And now I think for those of us involved in politics, I think a lot of questions still revolve around what happens in the first congressional district. And also, remember, Paul Ryan has a massive political war chest. And the question will be, where does that go? And who gets to benefit from all the money that Ryan has been able to raise in the past several years?
You're with us on Week in Review. Owen Robinson is here. He's a columnist at the West Bend Daily News, blogs at bootsandsabers.com. Annalise Eicher is here as well, and she is a program director at partner organizations One Wisconsin Now and One Wisconsin Institute. Gathering your thoughts on the news out of House Speaker Paul Ryan, 800-642-1234. What do you think is going to happen next in Washington following Ryan's announcement that he won't run for re-election? Do you think Ryan's decision will lead to other Republicans not running as well? What do you think this means for Wisconsin now that we won't have someone from our state in the top tiers of power in Congress? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So we're talking a little bit here about the first district becoming significantly more competitive, Annalise. There are already two Democrats in the running, Randy Brice, Kathy Myers. And meanwhile, Paul Neelan, who lost to Ryan in the Republican primary in 2016, he's already been campaigning against the House Speaker. And speculation has run rampant over who might join the race. So pull out your crystal ball. What are you watching in this district?
Well, what I'm seeing in the first congressional district is a lot of energy among progressives and Democrats. They have had they have a robust primary down there. They have two candidates who have been campaigning for months, who are, you know, sharing their ideas and garnering support, and voters are energized. You know, and I think, you know, the trend that we're seeing, you know, in special elections, particularly leading up to the November 2018 elections, is that your folks are excited to vote for a progressive candidate, and they have two good options campaigning, you know, and competing for that Democratic nomination. You know, so I think, you know, whatever And whoever decides to, you know, get in the Republican primary outside of white supremacist Paul Nehlen, you know, it could be very interesting. You know, I know that we've heard who's not running. You know, Reince Priebus said that he's out. Robin Voss just this morning said that he's out, which is unsurprising given that, you know, he is being investigated to an extent over lobbyist paid trips to foreign countries, for which his counterpart in Ohio is actually resigning over. Mm. You know, and so I'm really curious to see who jumps in. I think, you know, there's a couple of names that are out there, a couple of sitting state senators, a couple of state reps. You know, Dave Craig has a free role. His Senate seat's not up this year. If he wants to run for Congress and have a go at it, he could very well do that. Does he have a great record to run on? I don't personally think so. You know, Sam Kirkman from there down there, she had also dropped into, you know, was reported she was dropping into the press room talking about how, you know, she would consider it. And the other name that's been really interesting is Janesville native and friend of Paul Ryan and current UW regent, Brian Stile, which is a name that a lot of folks haven't heard in a while. But he is someone who, you know, is well-connected in Janesville, well-connected to Paul Ryan, and could make for an interesting Republican primary. But regardless, you know, the progressives and Dems are excited.
Well, Annalise is name-dropping, Owen. So who will jump in? Are you going to name names?
I think we'll name a lot of the same names, frankly. And what's interesting is I think the dynamics have changed dramatically where, you know, the Democrats, frankly, they're Randy Brights is a joke. I mean, he's a far out left guy. The left wingers, the progressives like to get excited about him. They like to throw money at him because they like to poke fun at Ryan. But he was 20 points behind in the most recent internal polls out of that district. He doesn't really match the makeup of that district. It's kind of a middle of the road, blue collar kind of district. And that's he just doesn't fit that mode. He's a deadbeat dad. He was kind of the same kind of candidate that the Democrats have run against Ryan for years because they knew that Ryan was going to beat him. So it was so they throw kind of joke candidates up. But now it's an open race. Now it's serious. And now I think we get the serious candidate. So I think on the Democrat side, I think Peter Barca would be a very, very interesting choice. He served in that district. He has that kind of middle of the road. You know, he's one of the few relatively moderate Democrats left out there. He may fit in the district. He supported, you know, the development with Foxconn and all in his district, you know, in that area. So I think he certainly would be a very interesting candidate and very, you know, very powerful, very, very tough to beat in that as a Democrat running. On the Republican side, we know Voss is out. We know the people are throwing out Reince Priebus. He's out. You know, I don't think any of those were serious about running. You know, I think the name you mentioned there, Annalise, with Dave Craig, I think is a very interesting candidate. You got to remember, he was an aide to Ryan for almost a decade in the district. So he knows that district very well. He knows the people. He knows the constituents. You know, he's served there. He knows them very well. He represents a part right now in the state legislature. He represents a part of the district that has a high density of the population from that district in the Franklin, Muskego type area, you know, southern Milwaukee County kind of area. So he has a lot of the population that already knows him and is representing them. So I think he would be a very interesting candidate to run. But I think, the difference is that the candidates now, I think on both sides are going to be, you know, Ryan's had that district locked up for so long that now you're getting a lot of that bench strength coming from both sides of the party of people who wanted to run for that seat and are serious and thoughtful. And I think it'll be
ramping up. Right.
Right. Right.
Let's bring in Joe in Madison. Joe, go ahead.
Well, I think Paul Ryan is resigning from the speaker because he wants to run for president in 2020. And he'd be probably the best candidate the Republicans could put forward.
Why do you say that, Joe?
Well, I think Trump is unpopular. And I don't think Trump likes the job too well. He's used to being the absolute boss. And as president, he's not the absolute boss. I think he could say that he had the job, did a good job. You know, he put a spin on it that his administration was a great success, but he just doesn't want the job anymore. And I could be the best candidate the Republicans could run.
Joe, thanks. So, Annalise, Ryan 2020.
Sure, Ryan 2020, but what is he going to do between now and 2020? Just sit on his war chest? Is he going to take more time away from his family and campaign around the country? I know we're looking at 2018 here in a couple months, but, you know, 2020 is right around the corner. Folks are already, you know, starting to emerge and form, you know, ideas about running. And, you know, stepping away from the Speaker of the House and essentially calling it quits on, you know, on his district, on the American people, and then saying, actually, I'm ready to lead again. I find that troubling and a little, you know, just it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Let's bring in Tina in Lake Geneva with thoughts. Tina, go ahead.
Quickly, I just wanted to say, unless I missed a statement that he gave, had he been elected vice president, he would have moved his family into the vice president residence and had his children with him. So I don't think that's an indication that he's been disingenuous about these past 6 years. And then going forward, I also believe that he is probably considering a presidential run. I'm a Democrat, and I would vote for him.
Annalise, do you want to respond there?
Sure. I'll just say this. Paul Ryan is not our vice president. And now he's quitting as Speaker of the House. And I think, you know, as he's heads for the exit, there's going to be a bunch of his Republican colleagues joining him. And the tide is turning. And there are progressives and Democrats who are ready to vote for progressive candidates across our country. And I think we'll see that in 2018 and perhaps even in 2020.
We have made it to Friday, combing through developments, and we can review our analysts this week. Our Annalise Eicher, Program Development Director at One Wisconsin Now. Owen Robinson is here, columnist at the West Bend Daily News. And you at 800-642-1234. What do you make of President Trump's tweets about potential U.S. missile strikes on Syria? Do you think the U.S. will actually launch a military attack against Russia, Russia-backed forces in Syria? Do you think the Assad regime will be challenged for suspected chemical attacks? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back to the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The White House says President Trump has spoken to leaders of France and the UK regarding potential military strikes in Syria as allies consider how to respond to a suspected chemical weapons attack that killed more than 40 people. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis testified before the House Armed Services Committee yesterday. He pushed for more evidence of President Assad's role in a suspected chemical attack.
I believe there was a chemical attack, and we're looking for the actual evidence. The OPCW, this is the Organization for the Chemical Weapons Convention. We're trying to get those inspectors in.
We're getting perspectives on the situation in Syria with Owen Robinson, a columnist at the West Bend Daily News, and Annalise Eicher. She's the Program and Development Director at partner organizations One Wisconsin Now and One Wisconsin Institute. And you can join this conversation on how the U.S. should respond to Syria, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Owen, let's go back to you with dozens of civilians in Syria dead in this alleged chemical weapons attack. We just heard there from Jim Mattis. The president warned Russia and the world on Twitter on Wednesday of a potential military strike. And then, of course, yesterday, the defense secretary, Jim Mattis, telling Congress basically that he believed it wasn't a chemical attack, but he really wanted more proof. Let's take another listen here of Mattis.
If, like last time, we decide we have to take military action in regard to this chemical weapons attack, then like last time, we will be reporting to Congress just as we did when we fired a little over a year ago.
So, Owen, what's sticking out to you here about the movement on this issue?
Well, I think, Syria is obviously a very complex thing, and there's a lot of issues going there. I mean, first off, you have to realize that what's going on in Syria is not just about what's going on in Syria. We have returned to an era of big power geopolitics, and so Russia's at play. You have EU, you have the Iranian interests. There's a lot going on in Syria. It's really the nexus of a lot of different issues. And I think that one thing that's changed is there's no doubt in the world that when Trump makes a threat, they take him a lot more serious than they did when Obama did. And I think we all do because we know Trump is capable of it. I think what I struggle with Syria is especially taking Trump's doctrine of America first, is understanding what the U.S. national interest is in Syria. Certainly there's a moral prerogative as people are being killed to do something. I struggle personally to draw that moral difference between killing people with bullets and killing people with gas. They're both horrible ways to die, and it's been happening now for years, and we have chosen not to step in and do anything about it. So I'm not sure why right now that's the catalyst that we should do something. I think we are going to step in as the United States, and I think that we all know there's very little appetite in the U.S. for yet another war in the Middle East, for putting American troops in there, for American treasure, for continuing to run up the national debt. I think there's very little appetite for that, especially not understanding what the goal is.
Well, Owen, with that said, more than 465,000 Syrians have been killed. 1 million more have been injured. President Obama in 2012 said a red line with chemical weapons there. How should President Trump respond?
I think and remembering that Obama then did not follow through on that threat, I do think that just for American stature in the world and making sure that we are believed and trusted, that when you make a threat, you have to be willing to carry through on it. And so I think now that Trump has made the threat, he has to be willing to follow through on it. To what extent is what we don't know. I mean, so is a retaliation against Syria, we're going to lob some missiles in there or, run some airstrikes and then we're out? Or is he talking ground troops, or is he talking full-on invasion and regime change? I think that's what's unclear, and no one from the administration has made clear to the American people yet. And until they do, I don't know that there's a lot of appetite for just doing things for the heck of it.
Annalise, join in here. Where do you come down on Syria right now?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, that Owen and you brought up President Obama, because when Obama was president, Trump actually repeatedly cautioned, if you will, Obama, saying things like many very bad things will happen if the U.S. intervenes in Syria. And, you know, now we're at a point where he is using 280 characters at a time to boast about his ability to launch missile strikes. You know, he is using his Twitter account to threaten other nations. And this is the same person who, you know, previously claimed he would never telegraph military action. I think the response from Trump here is troubling. I think it's dangerous. And I think it's a little embarrassing, particularly as, you know, the United States has been seen as, you know, as a world leader, as a country that, you know, has a little bit more caution and doesn't necessarily go about advertising what we're doing on Twitter. You know, I really think that this is showing that he's unable to do this part of the job correctly. I really believe that at this point we need Congress to step up and fill that leadership void. We need some answers from Trump on his actual Syria strategy that does not necessarily, you know, just include firing off tweets at random.
Let's go to Rick in Park Falls with thoughts on Syria. Rick, go ahead. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I'd like to mention just a couple of factors. Number one, Sergei Naryshkin, who is the head of the Russian SVR, that's Foreign Intelligence, made a specific threat on the radio to the United States of America a couple of weeks ago. And in the latest airstrike order by President Trump a while ago, something like 200 Russian military personnel were killed. Now, Russia is a very dangerous adversary at this point, And although I'm not opposed to what President Trump's actions may be in Syria, I think we need to do this with great unity with our NATO countries so that we don't go in here all by ourselves.
Rick, thanks for the call. Owen, Cold War adversaries here could get really complicated in Syria.
Right, and I think Rick brings up some great points. And so to the point, if we do go into Syria, there are very many bad things that could come from that, some of which includes a larger escalation into a larger global war, or at least multiple conflicts all manifesting themselves out of the same battle with Russia. And I think what we've seen with Russia over the years is they've become increasingly totalitarian again under Putin, and they have become much more aggressive in the Ukraine. They've shown a willingness to invade other countries. I think that, you know, it really does. It could escalate very, very quickly and very badly. So I think anything we do, we have to be cautious of. So I think to Rick's point, and what Trump has already been doing is trying to build a coalition, trying to get our European Union partners in Britain and France and Germany to get in there and help. One of the disappointing things I think we've seen in that region is over the last decade, we've seen Turkey move away from being a staunch ally of the United States to being more and more in Russia's sphere. And Turkey is not only strategically located in a place that influences that entire region, but also they have the manpower and all right there on the border with Syria to be able to really influence what's going on there. So I think we've seen this region drift more into Russia's sphere. And the question then becomes, from a geopolitical sense, is this something the United States is willing to expend lives and treasure to bring them back into the American sphere, or do we write them off to Russia? And I think that you know, one of the good things is that over the last decade, we've also become oil independent if we choose to be so. So we are not beholden to the black gold coming out of the Middle East that we were two decades ago.
Let's bring in Mark in Appleton now. Mark, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just regarding Obama's statement about the red line, I mean, I grant it was not a wise thing to say, and he said other things that were not helpful. But I don't think we should forget about the fact that Syria had huge stockpiles of poison gas, and they had to give them up. They were taken out of the country. So even though there's these chlorine attacks now, which are dreadful, things could have been far worse. And we should also shouldn't forget that Obama did go to Congress. He asked for support in taking military action, and Congress refused to do anything. So while Obama is open to criticism, I think the former comment was a little too one-sided.
Mark, thanks. Another comment from Appleton. John now in Appleton. John, go ahead.
Thank you, Kate and guests. I appreciate each one of you. Why don't we have a National Day of Prayer for Syria and all other hotspots around the world, devote a certain day of the year for the countries in harm's way? And then let's elevate some Syrians who live here and show what a blessing they are to our country. I'm a liberal, but I'm a Catholic, and we need to embrace people versus threaten them and be a big bully around the world to them.
John, thanks so much for the call. Annalise, millions of refugees flooding out of Syria. The U.S. has taken a handful, 11, I think, that we talked about as we were looking at humanitarian relief yesterday in the conversation. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, important that, you know, in these times that the United States opens its doors and allows those of us, you know, to show our compassion for refugees. And I think what's sad is that, you know, in the past we have been, you know, great at this. And under Trump, you know, there has been a shift, you know, that he doesn't want folks from certain countries to be here regardless of the circumstances that they're leaving and trying to leave so that they can lead happy, healthy, successful lives. And, you know, so, you know, I would agree with, you know, the caller, you know, yes, we should uplift them and their contributions to our country. But at the same time, you know, we have to be welcoming to all refugees and those who are seeking to better their lives here, which is, you know, how many of us ended up here in the first place.
Well, before we pivot to Pompeo, let's go to Lynn now in Superior. Lynn, go ahead.
Thank you. And it sounds like this comment may be going on the heels of talking about refugees, but my comment was if we're concerned about the gassing of these kids and families in Syria, then we need to open the door to resettle refugees from Syria. It's just absurd that we would respond with bombing, but our doors are closed for a humanitarian response. Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. We're going to leave it there and move on to the next thing to tackle of the week's developments. Congress held a confirmation hearing for former CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who's been nominated by the president to be Secretary of State. If confirmed, Pompeo would be the second Secretary of State for the administration in less than 15 months. During 5 hours of testimony, Pompeo told senators he hoped for a diplomatic solution to the North Korean nuclear crisis, believed that the Iran nuclear deal could be saved, and disagreed with the president's comments that poor relations with Russia are caused by the investigation by the special counsel. So, Owen, what do you think of Pompeo, and should he be confirmed?
Well, I think what's clear right now is we need a Secretary of State. We have a lot happening in the world. We've seen progress in North Korea. We've just spoken about what's happening in Syria. There are certainly other world conflicts, but also our economic issues with China, with NAFTA going on. I mean, all of these things involving other countries. We need a Secretary of State. We need a Secretary of State that's in alignment with the president's priorities. Even if you disagree with those, we would rather, you know, it's his right to have a cabinet that supports his views, and certainly his obligation to fill those roles with people who are going to be effective in those roles. I think what we've seen with Pompeo is he's been effective in his current role. There's no reason not to confirm him. I think people disagree with him politically. He may be too hawkish. Much of his testimony has been around trying to dispel the notion that he is too hawkish, that he will lead with diplomacy, which is certainly the obligation of a Secretary of State. But I don't see any reason not to confirm him. And right now, we need somebody at the Secretary of State. We need a Secretary of State and somebody in the State Department willing to lead and willing to fill those roles. And the alternative is to completely let Trump run foreign policy through Twitter. So I think I would much rather have a competent Secretary of State in place to run our foreign relations.
Annalise, any reservations there on Pompeo?
Yeah, I would say, is there a C, none of the above option for either Pompeo or Trump running on Twitter? Like you said, he's going to be the potentially second Secretary of State in 15 months. He is simply joining the ranks of other problematic nominees that Trump has put forward. DeVos, Pruitt, Sessions, Carson, Perry, the list goes on. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, he, you know, would necessarily be the best choice as our Secretary of State, particularly given his disparaging comments towards American Muslims and other folks who are citizens of this country and make incredible contributions. I don't know that we need a Secretary of State who shares the views that Pompeo does.
And very quickly here, he said he had spoken to Mueller in the Russia investigation, but he refused to describe what he had said despite persistent questioning. Owen, was that the right move there, or should he have addressed it?
I don't think he should have. I think that was the right move. Frankly, that's an investigation that's gone rogue already, and having him throw out just red meat for Democrats to seize on was going to not do anybody any good. But I think to Annalise's points, there's nobody Trump would nominate that I think the Democrats would agree with. So at this point, we're looking for somebody who's competent and will be able to step in there and run. And I think the alternative, again, is to sit back, go through another 6 months of not having a Secretary of State at a critical time in our nation's history when we need some leadership in that cabinet department.
We're moving through the week's developments with Annalise Eicher, Program and Development Director at partner organizations One Wisconsin Now and One Wisconsin Institute. Owen Robinson here as well, columnist at the West Bend Daily News. You can join in on Week in Review, 800-642-1234. Did you watch Mark Zuckerberg's testimony? Did his testimony change your opinion about Facebook at all? Do you think that Facebook is a monopoly? Do you think it has any legitimate competitors? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network.
Are you aware of other third-party information mishandlings that have not been disclosed?
Congresswoman, no. Although we are currently going through the process of investigating every
single you're not sure
that had access to a large amount of data.
And all right, but I only have 4 minutes.
That exchange there, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who made his highly anticipated testimony before Congress this week over the 2 days, almost 10 hours of hearings. He faced nearly 100 lawmakers who scrutinized Facebook's handling of user data privacy concerns. We're getting perspectives on Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Annalise Eicher is here. She is program director at One Wisconsin Now, and Owen Robinson here as well, columnist for the West Bend Daily News, blogging at bootsandsabers.com. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Curious, did you follow Mark Zuckerberg's testimony? Did his testimony change your opinion about Facebook at all? We're also going to turn our attention later in the hour to a raid on the office and hotel room of Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen. What's your opinion on the FBI's raid of Trump's personal attorney? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Morning. So Congress questioning CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and this comes 2 days, 10 hours, the call for regulation coming from some critics about revelations that Facebook failed to protect data of as many as 87 million users. Owen, is considering regulation the right avenue here, the right thing to do?
No, it isn't. And I think that certainly the abuses that Facebook has done are a violation of their user agreements, and that the users should be very upset. But that's up to them to take up in civil court. What I don't want is, frankly, and if you saw some of that testimony, it's very clear some of those senators have no idea how social media works. but I certainly don't want them having their hands in trying to regulate it, because all they're going to do is mess it up. What I find most fascinating about this entire episode is that if you didn't think Facebook was taking your data, amalgamating it and selling it to other companies, you're an idiot, because that's what they've been doing. It's what their entire business model is predicated on. And something I've told my kids ever since they got on the web, and I certainly know myself, is that if you're not paying for it, you are the product being sold. So if people don't pay to use Facebook, they get on, they use it, they put up their preferences, they fill out polls, they post pictures, they check in at locations. All of that data is going into a massive database that they're running algorithms against to create profiles that they then sell to other companies to either market to you by political campaigns or by businesses. So that is their business model. And if you didn't know that, you're a fool and you shouldn't be using Facebook in the first place.
So, Annalise, should lawmakers trust Facebook to self-regulate?
I think it's funny. Owen and I are going to agree a little bit here. You know, I joined Facebook back when you still had to be a college student and have a .edu email address. So I've
early
been
2000s.
On, yeah, I've been on Facebook almost my entire adult life here. And, you know, it really was no surprise to me watching that, you know, the old folks in Congress are not so hip to what's happening on the internet.
Average age in the Senate, 63.
Correct, yes. But in all seriousness, this is really serious stuff. And, you know, Facebook is an advertising medium, arguably a monopoly. And we've seen that this system and this company and this data is really open to manipulation. And as much as we try to protect it, folks' privacy can be compromised in ways that we would not likely consent to, if we really knew what was going on. But I think that our tech advances are currently outpacing our consumer protections, and that, you know, there should be and could be some steps taken to sort of restore that balance. I don't 100% know what that is, as I am
but
not in that world.
But did we get anywhere in this testimony here? I mean, 10 hours. Did we get anywhere?
You know, I don't know that we did. I think maybe the folks in Congress learned something. But I think folks who are, sort of aware of Facebook and aware of the, you know, information and being online, and that it is an advertising, company, if you will, I don't know that we really did.
Let's go to Tom now with thoughts in Green Bay. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Good morning. Just my thoughts on this whole thing is, obviously, Mr. Zuckerberg is a very intelligent and talented person that has come up and built this platform. So I'm just trying to figure out if it's anything more than just a show to have a bunch of old lawmakers sit there and grill the guy about a whole bunch of stuff that they know nothing about anyhow. I mean, these people don't know anything about a technology platform or privacy gathering, or they don't know anything about any of that. So, I mean, is this just all a big show, or what is this?
Owen, is this all a big show here? This was Zuckerberg's first time before lawmakers.
I think it's a reaction from politicians whose natural reaction to anything is to want to regulate it. They don't understand it. They don't like what it's doing, so they want to regulate it. So I don't think it's a show from their standpoint. I think one of the most fascinating things that came out of it is, you have to remember, Mark Zuckerberg is Facebook. He's the owns 60% of the shares. He controls the board. He's the creator. He's the CEO, the founder. He is Facebook. And yet, based on his testimony, he appears to have no idea how his business runs or why. He expresses confusions about how cookies work. He's going to have to let their team get back to you and all this stuff. He knows that stuff. So it's one of two choices. Either, if you're an investor in Facebook, either you have a founder and CEO who has no idea how his own company works, or he's lying to Congress. He wasn't under oath, I should say. So it certainly didn't violate any laws there, but I certainly don't believe what he was putting out there.
Let's bring in Nate now in Milwaukee with thoughts. Nate, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I know there probably or definitely were some privacy violations in the putting together of the data that was used in 2016. But when I didn't see him in front of the House, but I did see him in front of the Senate. And in front of the Senate, I was actually more impressed with Zuckerberg than a couple of the senators, because when he said he was going to have a political page where someone could actually go to and see all the political ads, and he was also going to include the issue ads as political ads, because everybody knows most of the time they actually are political ads, he was opening up the opportunity for the rest of society to fact check these ads. And it's sort of hard for the rest of society to do that when they're only delivered to people that that metadata says will be the most likely to not seriously question what they're seeing. And this, and the two senators who were questioning this, I felt like they were actually trying to protect the dishonesty in political advertising as much as anything else.
So Nate here bringing up the honest ads campaign that Facebook is trying to rally around. Annalise?
You know, the pulling all, you know, political ads and you know, being a little bit more transparent about, you know, what they're putting out there, I think that's all well and good. You know, but, you know, at the same time, it's still happening, and it's a massive company. And, you know, the internet is a large series of tubes, and, you know, there are a number of things that could happen. And I'll just go back to, you know, what I said before. I think, you know, the tech is, our consumer protections need to catch up with our tech, and we need to restore that balance.
Well, also this week, the FBI raided the office and hotel room of the longtime lawyer of President Trump, Michael Cohen, seizing emails, seizing documents on several topics and business records. President Trump accused the Justice Department of continuing a witch hunt, saying that the FBI broke into Cohen's office. Owen, what do you make of this move?
Well, I'm gonna agree with Democrat Alan Dershowitz in that this is a kind of a scary time in law enforcement, and that the violation of the attorney client privilege, where you have, instead of being accused of a specific crime, going through due process and subpoenas and, you know, getting information and discovery and doing everything you would do as a normal prosecution, we're seeing from the Justice Department very similar to what we saw here in Wisconsin with the John Doe probe, which is where the prosecutors pick a target. And then they go out and just try to scrape up everything, every communication, every contact, and then they flip through it and look for possible violations of crimes or even, you know, campaign violations and things that are relatively minor infractions. But meanwhile, they're going through all the communications that President Trump, who is still an American citizen and thought he was having private conversations with his attorney to represent his interests, which as Americans is all of our right to do. They're sorting through his stuff and just looking for stuff to see if they find something interesting that maybe they can try to prosecute him on. So as a private citizen, this kind of stuff scares the hell out of me, because if I have a private, I want to be able to have frank, honest conversations with my lawyer, with my attorney, if I have the government accusing me of something, and knowing that the government can now just on a, because they feel like it, go to my attorney and scrape up all my files and all my emails and all my communications and sort through it to see if they really think I'm, you know, they believe what I'm saying, then it really does obliterate the notion of having a counsel and representation.
Well, the president speculated about the possibility that he might soon fire Robert Mueller, the special counsel in the Russia investigation. Here's what the president answering a question from a reporter this week.
Why don't I just fire Mueller? Well, I think it's a disgrace what's going on. We'll see what happens. But I think it's really a sad situation when you look at what happened. And many people have said you should fire him.
So, Annalise, your thoughts here. Are you concerned about the Mueller probe and it going toward this witch hunt?
You know, look, this was a legally executed search warrant. And this warrant was sought by and approved by a bunch of GOP-appointed officials and career civil servants. So I think, you know, to write this off as a witch hunt is rather, you know, immature and it doesn't appear to be a witch hunt. You know, and I really don't think that there's any good way for Trump to spin this. You know, it's his actions and the people around him that are a bigger threat to our democracy than this legally executed search warrant.
Well, we're down here to just seconds, but Joshua in Madison has been holding on this. Joshua, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that your guest just brought up about it being legally executed. I don't see how these backers of Trump and defenders of Trump can, I mean, to me, they're basically saying that he cannot be prosecuted for past crimes. And how is that possible? So that's my comment. I think that...
Joshua, thanks so much. I want to get Owen with one last word here as we wrap up. Owen, go ahead.
I think this is, we all want crimes prosecuted, but this is the danger of special prosecutors who are alleviated from the normal due process and protections of civil liberties of Americans. I would rather them go through the normal judicial process where all of our civil liberties are protected.
Well, Annalise and Owen, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us, Kate.
Thank you.
Annalise Eicher is Program and Development Director at partner organizations One Wisconsin Now and One Wisconsin Institute. Owen Robinson is a columnist at the West Bend Daily News, blogs at bootsandsabers.com. This installment of Week in Review was produced by Brianne Shasso and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer, provided technical direction as well. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Thanks for listening.